91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today we discuss how the crime of rape and the victim is often perceived. Are there some urban legends and myths in societal views of the crime? Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. We'll visit with writer, columnist, and editor Kate Harding. In her book, Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It, Harding questions how women are conditioned to live with fear of rape. Why are successful prosecutions of rape cases so rare? And why are mitigating factors frequently given credence? A national survey has shown that over a lifetime, some 1 in 10 women in the U.S. will be raped by an intimate partner. Stay tuned. Author Kate Harding next on Topical Currents after the news. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. Today we visit with writer, columnist, and editor Kate Harding. Her latest work is Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It.
The book examines age-old feelings about rape, its victims, perpetrators, and the urban myths which still surround it. Kate Harding joins us now from Minneapolis. Welcome to you, Kate. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's good to have you. Isn't it quite a coincidence, Kate, that Bill Cosby was charged this morning with felony sexual assault in the case in Pennsylvania from 2004? Two questions for you. First, your thoughts on that.
I'm happy to see it. It's long overdue.
And why do you think he was criminally charged in this case and not in the dozens of others, cases of women who've come forward?
I think that, a lot depends on what evidence is remaining. You know, prosecutors will charge when they think that there's a chance of getting a conviction. And because so much time has passed, because he was allowed to get away with this for so long, even though it was an open secret, I think you can see that in many cases, the evidence will have degraded, or women might not want to go through with it, et cetera. So, I'm glad that they have that they're holding him accountable in at least one case.
Mm. Well, just for the sake of clarity for all of us, although the subject is certainly a worldwide concern and issue, you've confined your conversation in your book, Asking for It, about rape and rape culture in the United States. Correct?
Yes. I felt that if I tried to do a discussion of global rape, it would be a multi-volume work that would never end, essentially.
Right.
And there are other people who are experts in that in different areas of the world who are doing amazing work on that. But I know the states. I know Canada a bit because I've lived there. So I've got a little bit of that in there, too, which is a very similar profile in terms of the rape culture there.
Kate Harding, in the book, you mentioned 8 factors which lead media and public to perceive rape as not forcible. Could you go over those briefly?
Well, there are, I don't have those in front of me right now. I don't remember.
Highlights,
those are
highlights.
I know that they're Helen Benedict's from her amazing book called Virgins and Vamps, and which is a look just specifically into how the media handles these things. And it can definitely be things like the media pushing victim blaming, things like looking into what a victim looked like, what she was wearing, how much she had had to drink, that sort of thing. Very often the media will look into the accused person and really kind of give him so much of the benefit of the doubt. And in some ways you see quotes like, oh no, this boy will have to live with this for the rest of his life, when the problem is that the boy committed a crime, not that he got caught. And so you see the media generally just reinforcing these myths that are all over our culture, which is that women ask for rape, they bring it on themselves, that men can't control themselves, which is ridiculous, that, if women just restricted their behavior and their movements and didn't go certain places after dark, didn't ever go to certain neighborhoods or drink or anything like that, then they would rape-proof themselves and the problem would be gone.
Which is very dangerous thinking. We're going to get more to that. But do you think that at least now there's an increased awareness, or it's being taken more seriously, not only the news today, but, I mean, all these recent cases of sexual assault and rape that have received more notoriety, and then I'm thinking of the advertising campaigns by the NFL and the NCAA.
Definitely. I think that there's an increased awareness and certainly increased level of discussion since I started writing this book. When I sold it in 2012 on a proposal, I thought, you know, my publisher and agent and I all agreed I needed to get this done pretty quickly because rape was very much in the zeitgeist at that moment in a way it kind of hadn't been since the 90s. And we all assumed that that moment would pass. And in fact, you know, for the last 3 years, and it seems ongoing, rape is in the news in a consistent way and being discussed with more nuance and more awareness of these pitfalls and these myths that have for so long kind of dominated the discussion.
You know, in your book, you make a point of not saying that someone is raped every 7 minutes. You say someone is committing a rape every 7 minutes. Explain your thinking on that. And it's one of the basic messages you have in the book about the victim versus the perpetrator.
Sure. So often in the way that we talk about rape and sexual assault, we completely eliminate the perpetrator from the conversation. We say she was raped, he was raped. She was a victim, he was a victim, that sort of thing, instead of talking about who is doing the raping. And what that does is it allows us to kind of distance ourselves from who is the rapist. And it, you know, undergirds the myth that it's going to be this stranger in an alley who comes out and knocks you over the head, when in fact rapists are very often people we know, like, and admire. Sometimes, you know, celebrities like Cosby might be an example, and I should certainly underscore that he has been charged but not convicted of anything yet. But that very often the people doing the raping are people we don't want to believe would do that. And the more we talk about these crimes as if it's all victim, no perpetrator, the more we lose opportunities to discuss who's actually doing the raping and what we do as a culture to, if not encourage them, then certainly not discourage them.
Along that same line, how about the view that you express in the book of the traditional no means no mantra, that it should be more of an affirmative consent? In other words, yes, only yes means yes.
Right. I think that's something. I mean, no means no was great at the time when the feminists in the 70s were trying to get across the message that everyone has the right to say no, that they have the right to not consent to sex, even if they're married, even if they're in a relationship with someone. And so that's good but limited in its usefulness, where when we're talking about consent and what it really means to have affirmative consent from a sexual partner, you need to know that they are enthusiastically consenting, that they are affirmatively consenting, not just it's not just the absence of no. You know, for so long the standard was, well, was she kicking, was she screaming? And it should really be, what was she doing to indicate that she wanted it? And I mean, within the sexual situation, not, you know, how short was her skirt.
You make such an obvious point in your book that I have to tell you I never even considered until I read it, which is that mostly men fear that they could be accused of a rape they didn't commit, which, of course, we're going to get to in this conversation. Mm-hmm. While women, most women worry that they'll be raped. So talk about that and the pressure that it puts on every woman versus, go ahead.
Oh, sure. Just that, you know, I want to say, you know, the fear of being falsely accused is a very real and human fear that I can understand very easily. But when you look at the actual risk of that happening, which is about somewhere between 2% and 8% of reports of rape turn out to be false by various standards. When you compare that to the 1 in 5 risk of a woman being raped in a lifetime, or the 1 in 77 risk of a man being raped in a lifetime, a man actually is more likely to be raped than to be falsely accused of rape. And so we really focus so hard on this this thing with this relatively small chance of happening because that's what men fear more than they fear being raped. And again, I understand that. And there are certainly cases where, you know, I don't know if you've been watching the Netflix documentary Making a Murderer that everybody's talking about right now. But that begins with a man who spent 18 years in prison for a rape he did not commit. But again, it wasn't the the problem wasn't that some woman lied and then he went to prison for 18 years. The problem was the justice system broke down, that we are actually more likely to believe someone who comes in. Well, she was raped by a stranger. She just got the wrong guy. And that was a matter of what the police did, that they kind of decided on who this guy was, who did it, instead of really looking at what the evidence showed. So when someone actually gets into that Kafkaesque nightmare of, I have been falsely accused and I'm in the system for it now, that it's not just a matter of one woman lying. It's a matter of a whole justice system breaking down and having a whole bunch of problems, which can include an overzealous prosecutor, as in the Duke LaCrosse case. It can include police just ignoring evidence that would be exculpatory because they think they've got the right guy, that sort of thing. So when we talk about false accusations, I want to talk about the reality of it and the whole bigger picture, because too often we just let it come down to, well, you know, any woman who says she was raped might be lying, so we can't trust any of them.
And also you write that although these false accusations do exist, as they do with other crimes, tell us more about the form they take and the most common motivations for those who do falsely accuse.
Sure. So the most common motivations for, as far as I know, anyone who falsely reports a crime, including rape, is to get attention and sympathy. And so very often they will come in and they won't be naming someone in particular. So it's not like the fear of, oh, no, we have consensual sex and the next day she cries rape and comes and tries to ruin my life. It's more I would walk in and say, a stranger attacked me and I don't know who it was, but here's what happened. And so then you get the attention and sympathy that comes with that. And also, again, because we have this belief that real rape is the stranger in the bushes or the alley, as opposed to intimate partner rape or acquaintance rape, which are actually about, you know, that takes care of 85-90% of them. People who make up accusations of rape tend to have it follow that stranger pattern. And then
saying it was the man police, in the bushes.
Right, right. It was a man in the bushes. They aren't coming in and saying that, you know, my boyfriend or a guy I met at the bar last night raped me. They're coming in and saying that a stranger did this, that a stranger attacked me, there was a weapon, I was beaten. All of these things to try and create evidence, including sometimes, you know, carving things on their own body or, you know, putting bruises on their own body, that sort of thing. Because they know that if they walked in there with a really common rape scenario and said, you know, I met this guy at a bar last night, I got really drunk, I kissed him, and then before I knew it, he was raping me, like, the police aren't going to give you a lot of attention and sympathy for that. They're going to treat you like they treat a real rape victim, which is to suddenly interrogate you as if you're a criminal and you might be lying.
Mm. We're going to take a break on today's Topical Currents. We'll be speaking with Kate Harding. She's a feminist, an author, and a teacher. She's a columnist for Dame Magazine, and her work has appeared in numerous anthologies and publications. She's written Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture, and What We Can Do About It. We'll be right back.
And we resume our program, Topical Currents, this time with writer, columnist, and editor Kate Harding. We're talking about her book, Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It.
Kate, let's talk about the statistics now. I'd like to get to law enforcement and criminal justice system when it comes to reported sexual assault or rape, some of which you just mentioned. But what are the statistics on conviction of offenders? Do you have that?
Very, very low. And a lot depends on, I mean, when you begin with the fact that rape is a significantly underreported crime, so there are many that are just never even being reported. Once they're reported, they go through the police investigation, and then whether it gets to a prosecutor, you lose more at that point. And then if it actually gets all the way through to a conviction, it ends up being certainly less than 10%. RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, says that about 3 out of every 100 rapists will actually spend a day in jail.
Which is very surprising given our society's intolerance for sexual violence. I mean, it is almost up there with murder. Why this paradox?
Right. We have this idea that, well, we really believe that we think rape is second only to murder in terms of the most horrific violent crimes. But when it comes to how we actually treat it in society, that paints a very different picture. And I think that a lot of it goes back to what I was saying earlier about not wanting to believe that people we like or admire could commit these rapes. So we think of rape as an abstract concept, as a terrible thing. But then when someone tells you, you know, XYZ, real person that you know raped me, it's, oh, he could never do that. Or, oh, are you sure that that's what it was? Or, you know, are you sure you didn't send a mixed message, that sort of thing? It's really when it comes down to the individual level and actually believing that someone who wasn't just, you know, a drooling monster actually committed a rape, that's where we get hung up.
So I did refer to reported rapes. You just referred to the number that do you have statistics on the number of rapes and sexual assaults that do go underreported for all the obvious fears of being disbelieved or humiliated or raked over the coals about their sex lives or being accused of a false accusation or just not getting justice?
There are conflicting reports on that. And certainly you can say that more than half of rapes go unreported. But it's obviously the best guess because they aren't reported. So that's based on surveys of people where you're asking them, were they ever raped? Have they ever had an experience that would legally qualify as rape versus the numbers of people who are actually going to the police?
Kate, of course, you're in the title of your book, you talk about rape culture. How would you say today's rape culture differs from the feminist era, say, of the early 1970s?
Well, I think in some ways we've made a lot of progress where, you know, one enormous difference is that at least at this point, pretty much everyone has heard of the concept of acquaintance rape. They've probably heard even that that is much more common than stranger rape. So that's something that I feel like the feminists in the 70s were really fighting against, where they were just trying to get out the message that, yes, so many of these experiences that were previously categorized as kind of like, you know, bad dates were actually rape. They were actually a matter of one person deliberately dominating someone else and thrilling to their lack of consent.
Well, let's talk about what makes rape a crime, because it seems self-evident, but maybe it's not. Because you talk about dominance, control, so maybe it's not so obvious. What does make rape a crime?
Sure. It's a matter of making decisions about someone else's body for them without their input, violating their bodily autonomy, violating their ability to control their own person and their own life. And too often we think of, you know, the crime of rape being about kind of sullying a woman's purity, that that's very much how it was regarded for many, many years. And so that's what then feeds into the idea, well, if she wasn't a virgin, if she was actually, you know, interested in kissing him or touching him in some other way, if she has had, you know, a lot of sex before, if she's a sex worker, if she's, you know, someone with a reputation, that sort of thing, then how bad could it really be to have just one more penis inside her, even if she didn't want that one?
You know, this aspect that you talked about earlier, about a woman thinking if she does it right, if she doesn't drink too much, if she dresses conservatively, if she restricts her sexual behavior or represses her sexuality, she won't be raped. But that's such dangerous thinking because it has nothing to do with that. So not only is it wrong, but it's actually perpetuating a myth that can leave someone vulnerable.
Absolutely. It creates a false sense of security. Because, of course, all of those things that you're talking about, even if they were effective in preventing stranger rape, which I think we have no evidence to suggest that they are, you're still most vulnerable at home. That's where most rapes will take place. You are still most vulnerable among people you know or at least acquainted with on some level. And so the idea that if you just, you know, basically stay home under a blanket, well, that's not going to protect you if the person who wants to rape you is, in fact, your husband or your partner. So all of these things really give a skewed perspective of what the risk is. They give women a false sense of security, mm-hmm. and they just reinforce the myth that there are things that women can do to avoid being raped, and that's how you solve the problem of rape.
And again, it places the burden on the victim.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
If we could talk a little about this, if you don't mind your own experience.
Sure.
Do you mind talking about that?
No, that's fine. I often sort of joke that it was the typical after-school special kind of scenario. It was my first week in college. I went to a party. I got very drunk. This guy was bringing me drinks. I was underage. And so...
You were 17.
I was 17. And I had lots and lots to drink. And I left the party with him. And, you know, I don't even know what was going through my head in terms of where I thought we were going. Maybe I thought we were just going to make out. But I ended up kissing him on the lawn outside the party, which I was fine with. That was all consensual. And then he pushed me down and he raped me right there on the lawn. And I was just so dazed and confused and ended up, finding my way back to my dorm. And my roommate was there. She saw me. I was sobbing. She took me off to see the resident assistant the next morning, who took me to the hospital. And so I kind of, did everything quote unquote right in terms of going to seek attention, going to tell somebody immediately. And still, when it came down to it in the hospital, they said, do you want to do a rape kit? And which would involve calling in the police and taking evidence. And all I could think at the time was, I don't want my parents to know. And so when you ask things like, why don't women report? Why don't they... or why do they take a long time to report? Like that, it can be something as simple as that going through your head the morning after. So I didn't file any police charges. I did later, the next day in the dining hall, it was a very, very small campus, fewer than 500 students, and I recognized him. And I said to a young woman that I was with, that's the guy from last night. And she said, oh, no, I know him. He would never do that. And I took her word for it. I assumed that, I was drunk. I didn't actually get his name. So maybe I'm wrong about who it was, even though that was my just immediate gut impression. Like, there he was. And later on, I found out that that guy had, in fact, been accused of raping other women on campus. And so at that point, I brought up charges through the school. And the head of the committee that adjudicated this was the rapist's senior advisor. Yeah. And what they finally decided the verdict was that I had been raped, that I had all of this evidence that I'd been raped. So it would go on my transcript that was, an excuse for my poor grades. But they didn't believe that I had the right guy. And I think that that's one more example of how we want to believe that rape exists without believing that rapists exist. That it was, because my situation gave them a way to say, yes, this happened to you without saying he did it. That was how they decided to split the hair. Whereas if I had, said... from the beginning, if there had never been any ambiguity, if there had not been that moment in the dining hall where somebody else told me it wasn't him and I went, okay, maybe it wasn't him, then probably what they would have said was, well, it was consensual, you were not raped.
So in either case, would there have been any repercussions for the assailant, the perpetrator?
No, he was allowed to graduate.
But the important thing about your story, well, there's several things, but one I want to point out is that it made you doubt your own instincts, that it was he.
Yeah, exactly. All it took was one person saying that to me to make me doubt it for months until I heard that he had done this to other people. And then I went, wait a minute, that's the guy I said right away. But as I do say in the book, even now, you know, I would never name him publicly. I would not go to the police at this point because, there would be absolutely no point. There's no way that that's a winnable case. But also there is this tiny part of me saying, well, you know, even if it's a fraction of a 1% chance, but there could have been someone who looked like him, and there could just be this coincidence that I said this was a guy and then it turns out he had done it to other women. So even my own brain is trying, you know, wants to make the same kind of excuses that right. we tend to make because it just didn't want to believe what was right in front of me.
We're speaking with Kate Harding about her book, Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman, of course. We resume our conversation with writer, columnist, and editor Kate Harding. Her book, the one we're talking about, is Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. Our number, if you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, also email radio@WLRN.org. I think you have an email.
Oh, we do. And I just want to say, if you would prefer to remain anonymous,
certainly.
Just give another name when you call and just tell Richard another name. And the same with emails. I wanted to ask you, Kate, about rape culture and the military. And before I do, I want to read you an email that I got before the show. Rob in Fort Lauderdale writes, I'm a victim of military sexual trauma, male on male, that I didn't report because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. If this becomes, oh, and then please bring it up if you talk about that. It left me with severe PTSD. So why don't we address that?
First, I just want to say to him that I'm so sorry that he's been through that. We do hear a lot about rape in the military, except it tends to be in this heterosexual context, because people really like to say that, oh, well, that's the problem with, you know, putting women next to mm-hmm. women in the military and men. But just because of sheer numbers, because women are raped at a higher percentage in the military, but because there are so many more men in the military, in fact, male-on-male rapes are more common in terms of the sheer numbers than male-on-female rapes within the military. And so this is something that's extremely common that he's talking about. And part of it, I mean, it's such a complex thing, and the documentary The Invisible War is an amazing resource on this, as is Helen Benedict's book. I keep bringing her up, but she's a wonderful writer, that documentary was based on. It's something where you have this kind of perfect storm of this hyper-masculine, aggressive culture, lack of opportunities for people to express their own feelings of power, where they're sitting there and they are, you know, forced to take orders all the time. And then this culture where it's totally hierarchical and everyone will work to cover it up to protect the institution. And you see the same thing when you look at, rapes within the Catholic Church or within Orthodox Jewish communities or, you know, almost any religious community that's closed and hierarchical like that will have the same thing that the military has, which is people report rape and then the higher-ups work to cover it up instead of investigating and holding people accountable for it. And so I think that especially, during the era of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, that was just one more layer of you could be thrown out of the military for being gay because a man raped you. That's just a horrific situation that no one should have to be in. And it's kind of baked into the way our military works.
And, well, if you would talk a bit about the politics in our rape culture and some of the monikers that have recently even been given to rape by politicians, some of which are tied in often with religious views.
Absolutely. Very often when you hear politicians talking about this, it will be in the context of abortion and whether there should be a rape or incest exception to their anti-abortion views. And what you find is politicians saying things like, oh, well, you know, Todd Akin said, if it's legitimate rape, the female body has the way of shutting that whole thing down. You know, people talk about if there's an honest rape, if there's an emergency rape, or these are all things that politicians have said that that I talk about in the book, where everyone wants to qualify that because the default assumption is that a woman crying rape would lie. And especially in this context where they think, you know, it's a woman just looking for an excuse to have an abortion that she shouldn't be entitled to, in their view. So the default assumption is that a woman lies, and that means it needs a qualifier like legitimate rape or honest rape to really distinguish that from your average everyday rape, which is made up.
How do they construe an emergency rape? What does that mean? I don't understand that.
I honestly think...
what's a legitimate rape?
Well, exactly.
For that matter.
The emergency rape, I think, was actually Ron Paul, and I think it was... he was sort of conflating it with emergency contraception, where he was talking about, you know, basically trying to get around it by saying, well, if she was raped, I hope she would go to the hospital immediately and that she could be given emergency contraception so that, you know, abortion would not become an issue down the line. But, yeah, the way he said it was, well, if it's a real emergency rape situation. So that was what it was.
We have an emailer, which I don't know if you know the answer to, asking what your thoughts are, it's Alan, about Dr. Christina Hoff Sommer's criticisms of rape culture. Are you familiar with those?
I'm familiar with the vague outlines because they are typical. I think Christina Hoff Sommer is someone who has a lot of criticisms of today's feminist movement in general and tends to come at it from a bit of a more conservative perspective. And she has also written about how boys are, you know, being ruined by our culture, et cetera. And so I'm not, you know, I can't speak authoritatively on exactly what her criticisms are, but I can say that there are some people who think that the concept of rape culture is overblown, that that's ridiculous because, of course, as we discussed earlier, everyone thinks that rape is nearly as bad as murder. There are people who claim that these statistics are overblown, that they're false. When we talk about 1 in 5 women in a lifetime being raped, and that's, you know, coming straight from the government's surveys on that. And they think that, you know, feminists are trying to stop boys and men from experiencing healthy sexuality, which I think, you know, it's exactly the opposite of that. It's we're trying to encourage happy, healthy sex for everyone, where everyone is, you know, participating enthusiastically, as opposed to protecting some men's right to rape and claim it was consensual.
How does the internet culture affect rape culture?
You know, it affects it in good and bad ways, where one really amazing thing about the internet is that it can bring people together and help people find information and other like-minded people that they might not have been able to find just in, you know, their own small town or even in a big city. So if you are raped and you don't want to tell anybody about it yet, you can still go on the internet, find people who have been through it, find lots and lots of information that can help you. So that's, you know, it's a wonderful resource that certainly I didn't have over 20 years ago when it happened to me. But at the same time, there's a whole lot of reinforcement of some of these rape myths and a whole anti-feminist trolling culture that has kind of grown up. And people like the men's rights movement, which is not, you know, what we think of like drum circles in the woods. It's a specifically anti-feminist, anti-woman kind of loose internet movement that has grown up to really just push back on feminists as we talk about our lives. And so you see stuff and you see like relentless harassment of some women who speak out on feminist issues, especially in traditionally male-dominated spaces. Gamer culture has become a huge thing where even though there are lots of women gamers who are just as devoted, there are a lot of young men who feel like this is their space. It's the their last bastion of masculinity. And so they just viciously, viciously harass some women who speak out about sexism in gaming, including a woman named Anita Sarkeesian, who has done a series of videos highlighting some of the most sexist tropes in video games. She's been getting rape and death threats pretty much daily since that started. She has had speaking engagements canceled because people called in bomb threats. All of this because she's saying, you know, can we look at how women are treated as objects in video games and maybe think about the repercussions of that?
We're speaking with Kate Harding, and she's written Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. We're going to get to that after this short break. Welcome back to Wednesday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman continuing our conversation with Kate Harding, author, teacher, feminist, and columnist for Dame Magazine, the author of Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture, and What We Can Do About It. Kate, if you would please, I would like to talk about the role of social media, which I guess, too, is a double-edged sword. But if you would tell us about the Steubenville, Ohio rape of a 16-year-old girl by the star football players, and then I'd like to turn the tide and get to What We Can Do About It, part of your title.
Sure. So Steubenville was a case that was just starting to break as I started to write this book, so it figures fairly heavily in it. And it was a case of a 16-year-old girl who was at a party with a bunch of the star football players in a town that takes its football very seriously. And there were various forms of documentation of boys dragging this girl from party to party where she was at some points completely passed out, at some points just partially there. And witnesses who saw and videotaped and took pictures of them penetrating her. They were eventually, two were convicted of digitally penetrating her, which is rape, and various other sexual assaults. But it was something where these videos were going around and people were sharing them with each other. And this is something that, you know, I'm in my 40s, like I don't understand that kind of culture, although I should go back and say, too, that Peggy Reeves Sande, who's an anthropologist who writes about these things, talks about how in frats, you know, she wrote in the 90s about how frats would record things on an actual videotape, like long before digital cameras or the distribution, they would record rapes and then still watch them as a group. So this is something that, you know, the desire to do this kind of has always been there, but now we have the technology to make it so easy for people to record these things and then share them as just like, you know, salacious gossip. And then, of course, when it came time to prosecute, everyone started deleting all of those videos. So there was very little hard evidence by the time this actually went to court.
You know, there's an aspect of peer pressure here when it comes to the bystanders that who are watching this, you know, because there were some that spoke out, but there is pressure that they're supposed to approve of it, you know, especially when it's men and other men.
Yeah.
And even if they're opposed to it, they're afraid to speak up.
Right. This is something that you see in all of these cases, again, going back long before, you know, the digital era. That there are people when, you know, these kind of gang rapes that are driven by some, you know, sports culture and this, you know, sick version of kind of teamwork, there are always bystanders who just get up and leave because they think, I don't want to be a part of this. This is wrong. They maybe can't even articulate that it's rape, but they know it's something that they don't want to be a part of. And what we want to do is change things so that those bystanders, instead of just saying, I'm going to leave so that I'm not a part of it, will intervene somehow, whether it's actually trying to stop the people who are doing it, or if it's going and calling 911, if it's going and telling an adult, if you're a teenager at a party. This is one of the main things in the What We Can Do About It section is be better bystanders. So if we see things going on, and it can also be something as simple as, you know, if you see some guy who seems really focused on getting a girl really drunk, or if you see someone who is so drunk that it's clear they can't really make any good decisions for themselves, think about how to get them home instead of leaving them vulnerable in that party situation. Really just we want to try and change the culture so that we're all thinking about what we can do to make a less rape-supportive environment. There's also a study getting a lot of press in the last couple of days about how on game days at colleges, rapes spike. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the assumption is it has nothing to do with football in particular, but it has to do with alcohol. And so often our response to alcohol is, well, women shouldn't drink so that they aren't vulnerable. But it's also men who are drunk, and then that lowers their inhibitions, and then they rape. And so why aren't we also telling men, you know, hey, watch it. If your buddies are getting completely loaded and focusing on, some other person who's completely loaded, then maybe you want to step in and say, hey, buddy, I think you should go to bed, that kind of thing. We just need to change and stop acting as though every sexual interaction, whether consensual or not, between other people is something that we should kind of, you know, hold sacred as their issue and not something that we as a community have any should have any involvement in, even if it's happening right in front of our face and it's clearly something that makes us feel not quite right.
Speaking of action, Kate, tell us the story of the protest by Columbia U student Emma Solkowitz.
Sure. She's that amazing young woman who, after she was raped on campus and reported it and, nothing really happened to her satisfaction, she started carrying around a twin mattress from the dorm, like the one that she was raped on, as sort of a combination performance art and protest. And so she said, I'm going to carry this everywhere I go on campus for the rest of the year. And she did. And what was so lovely and heartening about that was that after she struggled carrying this thing around by herself for a little while, you would see other people would help her. And she, you know, she becomes mattress girl and people would help her carry it from class to class. And then it became something of a national movement. And there was a Carry That Weight Day where there were, on campuses all over the country, people were holding up mattresses in protest and basically saying to Emma Solkowitz and to all survivors of campus rape who didn't get any justice for it, you're not alone, and we want to help you carry that burden. And that's just symbolically, I think, just one of the loveliest differences between now and 20 years ago or 40 years ago, I think.
What other changing attitudes do you see? I mentioned the campaigns by the NFL. For whatever the reason, some people say their motivation mm-hmm. is not pure, whatever. There sure. is that campaign. There is the NCAA campaign. What else?
I think, we're seeing a lot of it, I think, because you can get this immediate feedback. And again, it's the value of the internet mm-hmm. and social media and of people being able to speak out who didn't necessarily have the venue to speak out about these things before, or to say, hey, this matters to us too, and hey, women watch football too, and we don't want to support people who rape and who abuse women. It's so other things that are happening too, I think there's so much happening on campuses that didn't used to be, where, you know, in my day, it was one Take Back the Night rally a year. In today's young campus feminists are doing things like, starting the website Know Your Nine and taking things to Congress and realizing, lots of universities now are under investigation for violations of Title IX which is because some young activists and their attorneys figured out that this title that protects the right to a campus free of sexual discrimination should mean that colleges are doing absolutely everything in their power to prevent rapes, to get rapists off campus, and most of them just are not. So we went from having no colleges ever investigated under that principle to about 100 of them, I think, now, and we're hearing more every day. And there are college activists behind that and really making sure that the information is available to other young women who are raped to be able to file these Title IX suits. So that's an incredibly hopeful thing to me. And I think just the fact that younger people are aware of it, of the concept of rape culture, that it's not necessarily this weird, scary phrase that no one's ever heard of anymore. People are starting to understand that it's a name for something that was always there. We just didn't have a name for it before.
What do you want to accomplish? What do you hope your book accomplishes at the very best?
I hope it helps people understand the big picture here, that it's not just one thing and that the little things kind of work together. So, you know, somebody makes a rape joke. No, that's not the end of the world, but it's part of this whole fabric of, you know, a culture that really kind of lets victims down and in many ways, whether consciously or not, supports rapists and supports the needs of rapists more than victims. So what I hope is that my book really shows the big picture of how these systems kind of interlock and make that happen, even if none of us at the individual level would ever say that we support rape.
Perhaps there are men or women out there listening now or who have heard you elsewhere who've been victims of sexual violence or rape and still ashamed of it, still blame themselves, still doubt themselves, never even talked about it perhaps. Are you hopeful that your book will also help them?
Absolutely. You know, I really want people to feel empowered to come forward to say that this happened to me and it is nothing to be ashamed of. It was not my fault. I think, you know, that's something that my generation of feminists even almost set aside because it feels like that's the work that they started doing in the 70s. But it's still something that's happening so much now, and especially in there can be cultural factors. There can be religious factors that create a whole lot of shame and secrecy and silence. And right. I always want to say to people, you don't have to live with that. You're not alone. And this is nothing to be ashamed of.
Has writing the book, Kate, helped you heal yourself from your own experience and your own self-doubt?
You know, honestly, I feel like I couldn't have written the book until I was pretty well healed on that point, which is why I didn't start it until 20 years after I was raped. But I do think that it's helped me articulate a lot of things that I sort of understood at a gut level, but not necessarily at an intellectual level. Before I really started researching this and, again, putting together that big picture.
Well, we want to thank you for being so open and not only here but in the book and direct. Kate Harning is a feminist. She's an author, teacher, columnist for Dame Magazine, and her work has appeared in numerous anthologies and publications. Her website is kateharding.info, and the name of her book is Asking For It, her latest book, Asking For It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. Kate Harding, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks for tuning in this hour. This is the last Topical Currents of 2015. All the best to our many listeners for 2016. Also, a special thanks from me and Bonnie to our small but productive, resourceful, and creative staff. That would be lead producer Richard Ive, technical director and online producer Paul Leary, and associate producer Polly Landis. Also, thanks to program manager Peter Mertz for his contributions.
I second that. You said it all. Wishing you a very happy, a healthy 2016, and we'll be looking forward, I mean, to seeing you back on January 4th.
Keep supporting public radio in the new year.
Please do.
For a free audio archive of this and previous programs, we have them at our website, that's WLRN.org. More information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. speechless?
I am. It's been a good 3.5 years now, Joe.
Yes, it has.
Yes.
It's been my pleasure.
It's been my pleasure, too, and it's been our pleasure to bring you Topical Currents. Have a wonderful and safe holiday.
Well, Bonnie and I return next Monday with a program about the debt collection industry. Those folks who collect on consumer bad paper. We hope you didn't run up any during the holiday season. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, thanks for listening. Here and Now is next from NPR News.